Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Good afternoon and welcome to FedSoc Forums. I'm Alex Zenos, Practice Groups Fellow at the Federalist Society. Today's Courthouse Steps program will be a discussion of Mullen v. Doe, decided yesterday by the U.S. Supreme Court. Joining us, we have Eric Wesson, Solicitor General of Iowa, and James Rogers, Senior Counsel at America First Legal Foundation. A couple of notes before we begin. As always, the Federalist Society does not take policy positions, and all views expressed in this session belong to our speakers. Towards the end of the program, time permitting, we'll take questions from the audience. So if you have any questions throughout the webinar that pertain to the topic at hand, please submit them through Zoom's Q&A feature located at the bottom of your screen. And with that, I will turn things over to our speakers to start today's conversation.
Great. Thanks, Alex. And thank you to the Federalist Society for having us on such short notice. We all knew that the Supreme Court was going to issue this decision yesterday. Joke, we did not know that, but it's great to be here. I plan on covering some of the, tackle and blocking background before moving into some of my thoughts about this case, Mullen v. Doe. But I think to bring the conclusion to the foreground, this is a case in which the Supreme Court respected Congress and the president's authority as authorized by Congress to do what Congress said he could do. And when Congress speaks clearly, the court listens. So this was a 6-3 decision along ideologically nominated lines. You had six Republican appointees in a decision written by Justice Alito, who wrote for the court except for Part 3A. Justices Roberts, Thomas, and Kavanaugh joined the opinion in full, and Justices Gorsuch and Barrett did not join that Part 3A. Justice Thomas wrote a concurrence that, as with almost all Justice Thomas concurrences, was fascinating in its own right and cut some new ground to explore in the immigration context. And then Justice Kagan dissented, joined by Justice Sotomayor and Jackson. And then I think it's important to also look at the broader context of this case or these cases. This was a case that addressed two different challenges to temporary protected status, which is a status that can be designated based on certain types of disasters in countries abroad. So far, that President Trump has tried to terminate 13 temporary protected status determinations, and lower courts have rebuffed him consistently in the face of even a clear jurisdictional bar. Before the Supreme Court granted cert and decided to take this case, it had already intervened twice to stay lower court decisions that now we know improperly found that the determinations could be stopped by a court. So to talk a little bit about the background, TPS itself grew out of a pre-congressional act. Basically, the executive branch would note that there was some kind of disaster or issue and want to give some kind of relief to people that come from that country. And these tend to be countries that were not able to be as helpful to their citizens as would be ideal. And that turned into the Extended Voluntary Departure program, which was an executive program that at the time, then Judge Silberman on the DC Circuit said was unreviewable itself. It's a separation of powers issue involving executive discretion. And that discretion ended up evolving over time into Congress's enacted temporary protected status program. Now, for the program as enacted, everyone agrees that there are four mandatory steps before any TPS status can be terminated. You have to consult appropriate agencies, you have to review country conditions, you have to determine whether the criteria are met, and then you publish notice. Now, the question is what happens if someone believes those steps aren't taken? And part of the law, Section 1254A, subsection B5A, explains that there is no judicial review of any determination of the Attorney General, which has now been substituted in for the Secretary of Homeland Security, with respect for designation or termination or extension of a designation of a foreign state. That's a mouthful. It seems pretty broad. And, you know, to cut ahead, that's exactly what the Supreme Court said. Also important for this case, and we'll get to this more later, is that these arise in an interim posture. That means that the determinations had not actually been vacated. They were just found likely to be vacated. And the reason that's important is, as we'll see in a little bit, that allows the court to reach the equal protection issue. So the main issue here is basically determining what a determination is and whether a challenge can be made to a decision or to a determination based on the process that leads to it. There are two different TPS designations at issue in this case, one involving Haiti and one involving Syria. TPS tends to be renewed or tend to be put in place and then must be reviewed and renewed or not on an 18-month sequence. That 18-month sequence can last for a long time. I believe the Supreme Court in Justice Alito's majority opinion noted that Somalia's TPS status went into effect in 1991 and that there were three other country designations for TPS that are more than 25 years old. That is a long time. So looking at the opinion, the question is were the district courts correct in finding that there were procedural issues leading up to what the district courts found to be improper terminations of the TPS statute? And the answer to that ultimately was no. And one of the key moves that sets apart the majority from the dissents was a focus here on basically the way under generalized administrative law act, Administrative Procedure Act principles and administrative law principles, subsidiary preliminary actions merge into the final decision. So when Congress makes an act of the executive judicially unreviewable, the antecedent actions that feed into that decision are themselves also unreviewable. Here, basically, that leads to, on page 18 of the opinion, what Justice Alito writes is, I almost see as like the payoff of the whole opinion, that this anti-circumvention merger doctrine ensures that challengers cannot avoid a judicial review bar by creative pleading or clever lawyering. That one sentence addresses the entirety of the dissent. And this is one where you have a battle of seeming textualism. On the one hand, you have Justice Alito explaining the determination and that broad language that I read earlier covers everything that that could go into a decision to terminate or extend or not to extend such a TPS, a temporary protected status. And on the other hand, you have Justice Kagan reading the words far more narrowly and saying that there is likely also invidious reasons behind those terminations. And then just because I'm cognizant of the time and I'm going to pass this over to James shortly, I do want to touch briefly on the equal protection claim, although I do want to flag the wrinkle, which is that Part 3A, which, as I mentioned at the beginning, was only joined by four justices, explained that the court had jurisdiction to reach this issue because of the preliminary posture of the underlying case. That jurisdictional hook itself is only joined by four justices, but there are six justices in the majority. So implicitly, two of those justices, Justice Gorsuch and Barrett, are happy to reach the merits, but they weren't going to join the analysis explaining of how they got there. On the merits itself, the Supreme Court assumes without deciding that the heightened standard under Arlington Heights applies the Equal Protection Clause here. Justice Kagan kind of scoffs at that in her dissent. She has like a wall of text paragraph where she highlights a bunch of language that she does not particularly care for from the president and Secretary Noem to accuse them of racism. Justice Alito responds to that by saying that the alleged racism here, where the administration is terminating TPS statutes, not only in Haiti and in Syria, which under American law is a country with white people in it, but every single TPS redetermination that has come up, and that the accusation of racism of everyone is not particularly persuasive. And that's actually kind of funny, because the respondents themselves here, the plaintiffs in the underlying lawsuit, are the ones that ironically pointed out the framing of the breadth of the desire of the administration to end these TPS statutes. These 13 countries where TPS has ended span every country in every region of the globe. And as Justice Alito noted, the only European country that has not yet had its TPS terminated is Ukraine. And that country's designation has not even come out yet. So that covers the majority. I guess one last point before I turn it over is I do think it is worth reading Justice Thomas's concurrence here. The two points that I would take out are, first, that the jurisdictional review bar reaches constitutional claims too, that because the district courts are creatures of statute, Congress is able to constrain their ability to review cases. And then second, that aliens have no equal protection right against the federal government. Justice Thomas would review Bowling v. Sharp, the Brown v. Board of Education partner case, would find that the reverse incorporation was atextual, and probably would find that there's not an equivalent of the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause in the federal constitution. All of this is really fascinating. This is not a super long opinion. All the opinions together are only 49 pages. But I could literally talk for 30 minutes about this. So I'm going to stop talking now, hand it over to James, and then I'm happy to answer any questions as they come in.
Thanks, Eric. Yeah, I wanted to just talk, first of all, about some of the historical and policy background to these jurisdiction stripping statutes in immigration law, in the Immigration and Nationality Act. A lot of listeners here may be aware, in the late 80s, there was this amnesty given to illegal aliens. And part of that grand bargain was to strengthen our immigration laws, and more stronger laws were passed in the 80s that were supposed to stop illegal immigration. Then again, in 1996, Congress passed a really landmark statute called the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigration Responsibility Act of 1996, IRA-IRA. And a lot of these laws that were passed in the late 80s and 90s adopted these jurisdiction bars that really restricted when you can challenge immigration policies, because what was happening was, is illegal aliens who are subject to removal were just filing challenge after challenge in district courts after they'd lost an immigration court to just extend the period of their ability to remain present. So there's been multiple cases where these jurisdiction stripping statutes have come up. And what happens is district court judges who, presumably because they disagree with the policy implications of more aggressive immigration restriction, have read those very narrowly to continue to allow aliens to file challenges. So there's been multiple cases like this that have examined different jurisdiction stripping statutes. And the statute here is just extraordinarily broad. It was read once before, but I'm going to say it again, read it again. There is no judicial review of any determination of the Attorney General with respect to the designation or termination or extension of a designation of a foreign state under this subsection. So no judicial review of any determination. And so the sticking point between the majority and the dissent was what determination means. And Justice Kagan said that determination is only final decisions. And Justice Alito goes through the different definitions and shows that a lot of definitions of just the common use of the word determination cover the process of reaching that decision. And also other definitions only cover the final determination, but under principles of administrative law, the whole decision is not subject to review. Congress couldn't have been clear that they did not want courts to be able to use for this problem to manifest in this context of aliens filing continuous challenges to restrict what the executive can do. So this was a very good decision for sanity and respect for the different branches of government and their relative roles, that Congress can impose these jurisdiction restrictions and that the executive does have authority to make decisions about temporary protected status. And this comes against a background where Eric talked about how some of these designations for TPS have just lasted for incredibly long periods of time, Somalia since 1991. And what's happened in the past, and this is an interesting open question that the court did not get to, is sometimes what has happened is there's some disaster in a country, TPS is designated, and the TPS designation will say, aliens who are in the country as of X date are covered by this designation. And what's happened with some of these redesignations, the Biden administration did this several times, is they change that date and they bring that date sooner in time to cover more aliens who have arrived after the TPS designation. And that's an interesting question about whether that date, whether when the TPS designation is renewed, whether that date can be changed. So this was a great decision to affirm that the executive has the authority. There's been a series of these Supreme Court cases affirming that these statutes that do grant significant authority to the executive really mean what they say. And in this case, particularly interesting, I think, also is the equal protection, which angle, which Eric referred to, is the plaintiffs in this case tried to have it both ways. They accused the administration of racism, but then they also had to note that the administration has denied redesignation of TPS for every single country that has come up for renewal. So clearly it's not based on racial animus against a particular racial group. So they were forced to just say all non-whites are being targeted, but they couldn't point to any specific statement that says that. And Justice Kagan cites general statements that President Trump made about some of the countries involved and said, had to acknowledge that they're not overtly racial, but just said that they involve stereotypes and tropes because there were no direct statements on point. So it's a well-reasoned decision. And like Eric said, Thomas's concurrence is very interesting for what he says about the Equal Protection Clause. So I think I'll leave it there and we can open up to questions or discussion.
I don't see any questions yet, so I'm just going to keep riffing until I see one. Oh, there's a question. How crazy would it actually be that if someone maintains TPS for X amount of years with good moral character, no crimes, we open a path to LPR, we can add an exuberant fee for the gov to take separate rather than the regular GC provisions, that way no way uprooting someone who set up their lives here for years? I think that's a great question. And what it boils down to is, you know, look at Somalia. The TPS designation went into effect in 1991. So if someone came here then and is still here today, 35 years later, is there a sense of fairness that is offended by ending TPS? And I would say, first, that's a policy question. And second, it's a policy question that Congress can answer. But what the Supreme Court does, and they really do try to stick to this gun, is they are neutral arbiters of what the law says. So, you know, I think Justice Alito actually says this in his majority opinion. He's not judging the actual policy itself on good or bad grounds, but he is saying that the law does not allow lower courts to review these determinations at all. But to the person that asked that question, if you want to go and lobby your congressmen or senators to change the law or to create some alternative way for folks to stay in the country, you can absolutely do so. I saw a quip today from Jimmy Percival, the Department of Homeland Security General Counsel. He was asked a similar question about where should some of the Haitians go, because some have been here for quite some time under TPS, and referencing the classic song Closing Time, he said, well, I don't know where they should go, but they can't stay here anymore. And that is frankly the right answer under the law. And it's heartening to see the Department of Homeland Security and the Supreme Court both giving full force to this statute that was enacted by Congress and signed by the president and is the law and should be followed. I don't know if you have anything to say about that, James.
Yeah, I would just add, you look at the status that's created by the statute, it's temporary protected status. So I don't think it's, there should not be a fairness element to ending a temporary status. The person should not have developed a reliance interest in remaining permanently because it's not permanent protected status. There are various immigration programs that allow someone to adjust status or to get a green card. And if they qualify for those are things that the American people through the representatives have established. But through TPS, there should have been no expectation. And if someone who is a recipient of TPS status feels somehow wronged, they should complain to the administrations that continually renewed a status that was supposed to be temporary.
Yeah. And so that dovetails nicely into the next question we got, which was about, with regards to Syria, which is one of the two TPSs that was canceled, is whether there remains an opportunity for Syrian religious minorities, Christians, Druze, Alawites, who might face persecution under a new Syrian regime under TPS. And I think this is, again, just like a little bit of a category error. There are mechanisms by which persecuted religious minorities can seek asylum or other relief, but that kind of individualized relief is authorized by different statutes and different programs and processes and isn't the intent of TPS at all. Let's see, does this case in El Acho Lado give us any hints as to how the court will rule on birthright citizenship? My view on that is no, although while I led the red state amicus brief in this case and also in the birthright citizenship case, state of Iowa, I'm not expecting that the executive order will be fully affirmed in that case. We'll see exactly what the Supreme Court does. I think that these two wins this week, though, are very meaningful wins. James, do you have any thoughts about the birthright citizenship case's outcome?
Well, I wanted to go back to the question before about individualized relief. And actually, I wanted to say one thing I forgot to say on the first question. What you were saying about the court making decisions about the law and not about policy, I think that was a flaw in Kagan's dissent, is she ends her dissent narrating the situation of some of the plaintiffs and the difficult medical problems they have and how their return to their home countries will present difficulties for them. And that's really not an appropriate grounds of decision for the Supreme Court that's evaluating the meaning of statutes. And so I thought that was inappropriate in her decision. But on the issue of whether certain religious minorities might have to go back to Syria, it's important to understand what does TPS allow? And the Congress enumerates what conditions trigger the applicability. And so it's ongoing armed conflict, earthquake, flood, drought, epidemic, or other environmental disaster, or the foreign states temporarily unable to handle the return of aliens who are from the state. So it's not about whether someone's subject to persecution in their home country. Those are what the asylum and refugee statutes are for. So it's really, like you said, a category error. And it's important to understand that TPS really wasn't designed to handle those kinds of people, and it's other statutes that handle that. On birthright citizenship, I agree. I don't think we can discern from this case what the Supreme Court's going to do on that one.
So next up, we have another fascinating question about an intersection of this case and another case, Kilmar Obrego Garcia and the Alien Enemies Act. So the asker says that in that case, he believes that the fact that Section 21 vests the decision in the president and two sections later defines the jurisdiction of Article 3 courts, does this case bear on how the Alien Enemies Act should be interpreted? Well, let me just say that the Aliens Enemy Act case in the Fifth Circuit is currently pending before the en banc court, and I would be pretty surprised if some folks weren't thinking hard about a federal rule of appellate procedure 28J, which allows for notices of supplemental authority, because I do think that that these cases, this one and the El Acho Lado case, both conceptually bring a lot to the table to help courts in understanding how to interpret the AEA. James, do you have any thoughts about the AEA?
No, I think you covered the interesting aspects. Given this question, I would like to go back and reread what the AEA says about the jurisdiction of courts. But the Alien Enemies Act is another one that vests substantial discretion in the president that I think this will help courts understand that when that discretion is vested, it really means it.
And then I just want to kind of take that one step further. The next question we got was, given the explicit language of divesting courts of jurisdiction, how did the lower court justify its action notwithstanding federal law? Well, my answer is I thought every single one of these TPS decisions was completely unjustifiable and that it required a bad faith reading of the statute and overly creative judicial lawmaking. And I hope that the language here and the language in El Hacho Lado are brought to bear in some of the ongoing disputes. Before we join this call, James and I were talking a little bit about the 1225 versus 1226 issue about mandatory detention for certain types of illegal aliens in the country. And there's a similar jurisdictional bar under Section 1252F. And this all sounds pretty technical, but basically the takeaway is, in federal immigration law in particular, Congress has repeatedly and clearly stripped lower courts from jurisdiction. And courts have, in the second Trump term especially, decided to ignore those jurisdiction strips, decide to assert jurisdiction notwithstanding those laws, and to issue results that I think are unjustifiable on the text. And the Supreme Court has stepped in a few times on the emergency docket. They've now stepped in here, converting this case to a full orally argued case. And I really hope that district judges, even district judges that have policy disagreements with President Trump on immigration, follow the Supreme Court's lead and take Congress seriously. You know, it's really amazing that the greatest offender, as far as I see it, of Article 3 and of Article 1 is President Trump, who is out there on the front lines doing his best to apply Congress's laws in the way that best comports with the writing. And sadly, a lot of district court judges, I think, seem to be substituting personal policy preferences for Congress just because they have a disagreement with the president. And I think that that is not the correct way to approach jurisprudence. James, I don't know if you have any thoughts about that one.
Yeah, I agree with your assessment. And, you know, it's always difficult to discern a person's internal motivations, but it sure looks like that's the motivating factor is policy disagreements. And as you talked about with what to do with people in TPS who are affected by this, who've been here for a long time, that if district court judges dislike the policies, they should run for Congress. But their role as members of the judiciary is not to set policy. And you see declining confidence of Americans in the judiciary because they see these things happening and lose trust in judges. So it's really an important thing that judges don't do this because it really affects the stability of our system. To address the question of how the courts justified taking jurisdiction, one of the reasons was the Administrative Procedures Act allows, you know, sets up the procedures for reviewing administrative actions of the executive. And there's a presumption under the Administrative Procedure Act that judicial review is allowed unless a relevant statute precludes it. So they just read the statute in so narrow of a way to say that it's not precluding review under the Administrative Procedure Act. But I think that's just sophistry and not a legitimate reading of what the statutes say.
Well, James, I think I've taken first lead on a bunch of the questions today. We've got 1 minute left. You are really more of a subject matter expert here. Do you have any takeaways that you want to leave the folks on this call with before we end?
Yeah, I guess you know, some of the questions focused on the personal situations that these policies affect. And that often comes up in immigration cases. And my mother's an immigrant to this country from Latin America. And so I'm not unsympathetic to those concerns. But on the other hand, government policy is about, you know, broad policies that affect the American people. And you can't make policy based on sympathetic situations that, you know, legitimately, you know, are of concern. You can't make government broad policy for the whole country that way. And it leads to sometimes very absurd and counterproductive results. And so the court did the right thing and just interpreted the statutes as Congress wrote them. We have a system of separation of powers where Congress, you know, this is junior high civics. Congress writes the laws, the president enforces them, the judiciary interprets them. And in this situation, it happened the right way. It took 1990s when the statute was passed. So it took 36 years for us to get to this result, but it was the right decision. It should have happened sooner, but thank goodness the Supreme Court took their role seriously this time.
Awesome. Well, it's been really great to get to talk about this with you, James. Alex, I want to thank you and the Federalist Society again for inviting us to participate in this discussion, and hand the mic back over to you.
Thank you. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our panel for sharing their time and expertise with us, and I want to thank our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.